Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Welcome to episode 27 of The High Low, the news and pop culture podcast brought to you weekly by journalist Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes. Welcome to our third author special. Some of you may remember the jolly old chats we've had with journalist and author of The Party, Elizabeth Day, and Rennie Edo Lodge. And we're back in the studio today with comedian Rosie Wilby, who has written a book called Is Monogamy Dead?, which came out in August. Rosie started writing the book in 2013 after she found herself questioning everything we are taught about monogamy in Western society. Welcome to the studio, Rosie.
Hi, lovely to be here.
Just so the readers can get into the meat of your book right away and your beautifully unique voice, we thought we might kick off with a reading from you.
Okay then, and you particularly wanted this one.
Yes, I did request this segment.
Okay then. I'd been too much of a monogamous prude to realise, but lesbians are sometimes allowed to have casual sex. Once every 2 months, apparently. Because that's how frequently the locker room, a gay sauna just off South London's leafy and affluent Cleaver Square, is hijacked by the women. Now that I was writing a show on sex infidelity, I could visit under the comforting guise of research. I'd been told tales of wild excess about what went on there behind the clouds of steam and sweat by gay male friends. Would women behave with similar animalistic abandon? I heard about the sporadic women's event through my friend Belle, who described herself as solo poly and explained this as engaging in multiple ethically non-exclusive relationships while abandoning the hierarchical structure of a primary relationship. To her, a lesbian sauna was no big deal. She had nobody to report her whereabouts to, and the partner she was with would totally get it anyway. Whereas to me, its very existence was a big neon sign, informing me just what a clueless, close-minded idiot I was. Belle and I agreed not to cramp one another's style. I would leave her to her own devices or vices. Yet if I was in any way uncomfortable, I was to go and discreetly belch in her ear. It was the most ridiculous safe word ever. I wasn't even sure I could belch on demand. Yet she had once heard a friend and his wife using it as a code, and the idea had tickled her enough to copy it. An amiable, bespectacled butch who seemed to be in charge proposed an icebreaker game in the cramped bar upstairs. Even though most of us were still clothed and sipping milky tea from polystyrene cups, there was a giggly frisson, the airless space rich with pheromones. Then a slender-toned woman a few years my senior strutted over. I'm Helen, she purred, fluttering eyelashes thick with mascara, browny-greying curls cascading around long earrings, droplets of silver pointing down to her glistening neck and chest. Rosie, I said, instinctively offering a handshake, a formal and robust greeting to legitimise what might follow. What do you want to do tonight? Oh, God, I hadn't prepared for this question. I thought to myself, I wouldn't mind an intelligent discussion on Britain's role in the European Union. Instead, I gulped. I looked over at Belle, wondered if I could employ our code this early into the evening. Fortunately, the bell rang. A pretty Asian femme, barely half my age, whirled round to catch my eye, long painted fingernails giving her sexual tourism away. You look like a film star, she proclaimed. Thanks, I said. Which one? This girl clearly had no idea what she was doing, which meant I wouldn't be exposed as not knowing what I was doing either. Once we'd descended to the steamy, dimly lit basement, a blonde woman started nonchalantly flicking through a magazine. A strange mix of aloof and slutty, she pulled down her bikini top to rest under her breasts. Then, in a moment of OCD, started folding towels and tidying. This was hardly the hedonistic gangbang I'd anticipated. But then the Asian girl leaned forward from the bench above and whispered, "Let's do something." The steam room was insanely hot, like climbing inside a kettle. There's no way I'd be able to stay in there long enough to make a woman orgasm. We started kissing awkwardly, like kids playing spin the bottle. Then, as the steam parted, I saw a familiar face. I tried to concentrate on kissing, but kept looking over. Who is that? Oh, yes, she's a regular at my gigs who often tweets afterwards with not entirely welcome feedback. I imagined her judging me this time, holding up a scorecard. Hi, Rosie. Hi, I blurted, sitting upright. And we all started chatting, as women do, then went upstairs for another cup of milky tea.
I just love that.
You read that so, like, mellifluously. I could have listened to that with a cup of milky tea. But also what I love is I think that
mellifluously. I like that word.
I think that's so many people in a sexy sauna.
That's what you said when I spoke to you today. I said, I just love that sex sauna thing.
The dribbly
thing.
Shower
and you
on
said,
timer.
I just found it so comforting that I know that's exactly how I would be.
I mean, I'd probably be the woman folding towels, but without the bikini top down. The fully clothed woman folding towels, clearly not participating.
A full body suit.
Exactly.
So just to begin, why don't you tell us a bit about how you started this personal exploration into non-monogamy?
And how the book as well came around.
Well, those two things are, of course, very, very linked because I'm a comedian, as you know, mm-hmm. and I did a show about 8 years ago now in 2009 called The Science of Sex, which was, unbeknown to me then, was the beginning of a whole trilogy about love and relationships. I became fascinated in presenting some serious points about the neuroscience of how we behave in love and in relationships in a very comedic, accessible way through a comedy show. And then I suppose my personal life altered because the relationship I was in when I was writing The Science of Sex ended. And for me, quite abruptly and in a sort of rather ambiguous and unexplained way. So around a similar time, a lot of my friends' relationships were breaking up too. And I realised that particularly among my peer group of gay women, most of us were kind of serial monogamists. And I actually became aware of one friend who I sort of opened the book with a story of one friend. Obviously, I've changed the names, but one friend who was, it turns out, having an affair. And obviously, that's a really awkward position to be in because you kind of realise something's going on, but you also really like that person's long-term partner. It's like, oh, God, am I supposed to say something? And so I became aware of all these tricky intricacies around fidelity, which I hadn't thought about too much before because I talk about in the book how growing up, TV dramas about cheating. It was always like a man, and it was always played by Trevor Eve.
and so binary as well. So
totally. Yeah,
very terrible, horrible man.
Heroic woman. Yeah. This binary idea, like you say, that women are very, very well behaved in relationships. And I thought, well, I'm going to be all right because I'm gay, so it's going to be fine. And then I kind of realised it wasn't really like that, and that for all of us, whatever our gender is, whatever our sexual orientation is, monogamy is a little bit of a conundrum. So I started researching the topic for my 2013 Edinburgh show, because I already had a show about feminism in the bag, but I thought, God, who's going to come to a show about feminism? Bridget Christie won the main prize that particular year. So yes, so I started doing lots of reading, and one of the key pieces of research I did was I designed a survey asking a few different questions, but the key one was what actually counts as cheating, because I realised that was less black and white than we think, and that revealed that there was this whole spectrum outside of the sexual activity that we might think of as cheating, where there's a spectrum of emotional monogamy as well, which is where things, I think, get really, really interesting, because a lot of people voted for things like falling in love with somebody else or texting or emailing or staying up all night talking to somebody. And also it became apparent that many of my friends had different language that they'd kind of invented, because our language around love and friend and all these kind of binary words is so ambiguous. So one of my friends told me that she had love affair friendships, and she'd kind of decided to call them that to denote some very deep kind of romantic friendships that were not sexual but had a real history and a real intimacy.
I was so happy when I read that bit, because it's the way that I feel. Pandora's the same. Pandora's got a group of very close friends that she's grown up with. And the way that I think of those particular friendships is I do honour commitments to them as if it were a marriage. You know, we know each other's families. We kind of prioritise each other. We have a really deep understanding of each other. We have a history. It looks like we have a bright future together that does feel a step beyond friendship. So it's so wonderful to see that described in your book.
Yeah, I mean, Dolly's written a book that comes out in humble brag, that comes out in February, and it's all about love, But what is surprising, but shouldn't have been surprising to me reading it because it is so you, is that actually it wasn't just about sexual love, as you say. A lot of it was about falling in love with female friends and those relationships and how they can hold you up and sustain you and propel you in life. What I find really interesting about the book is that it is incredibly nuanced and explorative and sort of gentle in its journey, which feels so accessible. But the title is obviously
a little bit provocative.
Powerful and provocative. And I actually left it in my local coffee shop and I went to pick it up the next day. And the Eastern European...
Been reading it?
Well, the Eastern European barista just said, well, is it? As he... That was not an Eastern European accent. I don't know what it was. Sort of Poirot. And he handed it over and I was like, oh, I'm not sure yet. I haven't read it. As if you were somehow going to give me the answer to whether or not monogamy was dead. But I imagine it can make people quite combative. Like, well, how do you know that, Rosie? Why is it dead? Why are you telling me I can't do it?
Yeah, they seem to miss the point that it is a question.
Yeah, well, as you explore in the book, it's this huge tenet of modern society that we really rely on, even though, you know, the divorce rate's higher than ever and clearly being sexually monogamous is not something that works for everyone. And yet we have never considered adjusting the scale or looking at what we expect of a modern relationship. So I think it's funny that it does, as you say, elicit maybe
it does.
A reaction.
It does. And I think I deliberately chose that originally for the Edinburgh show because in Edinburgh you have to sort of grab attention. You know.
I mean, I think it's a very good PR move.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about non-monogamy as a concept? Because for some of our listeners it might be... A kind of brave new world and something they're not very, don't have an understanding of. How would you define non-monogamy and polyamory and the kind of differences between the two for people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, it's ambiguous because, of course, people use different terms in different ways to suit their own particular situations because it's very much about communicating boundaries and your needs and desires with your partner or indeed partners and working out what works for you. I mean, monogamy derives from the Greek monos gamos, which meant sort of one marriage for life, whereas now we, of course, have adapted it to tend to mean one marriage at a time, and we're serially monogamous. And on the flip side of that, polyamory is, of course, many loves. So the interesting thing about that is that it actually means lots of multiple, ethically negotiated and agreed, consensual, loving relationships. And those don't need to actually be sexual. Mm. So arguably, you could simultaneously be polyamorous and monogamous, which is the really interesting thing. They're not necessarily direct opposites. Non-monogamy, the people I've spoken to tend to use that more to mean a specifically open relationship in terms of sexual partners outside of the relationship, whereas the people who are doing it in a slightly more kind of emotional way and counting all relationships, including friendships, as relationships, and sometimes those people might call themselves relationship anarchists, they would tend to probably towards using more polyamory rather than non-monogamy, which I think people who are in open relationships might lean more towards. But there's a bit of fluidity about how people use the term.
So it's the way that so many of us are living already. It's just that I didn't necessarily know the labels for it. So when you're talking about polyamory, definitely Dolly and I have. I'm married. Dolly's currently single, but both of us have polyamorous relationships. They're just, as you say, not sexual necessarily.
Yeah.
There was a great quote that you paraphrased by Alain de Botton, which I think really summarises the struggle in a monogamous relationship, whether you are non-monogamous or monogamous, about why anyone would seek to inflict their true selves entirely on one soul. And I've definitely felt that before. Yeah. I've definitely felt quite sorry for my husband that he's expected to shoulder the entirety of me.
I know. You know, the book was very much a response to this idea that, you know, in films where we do kind of see the happy couple get together right at the end as if that is the happy ending and everything's going to be fine from then on, and with no realistic kind of portrayal of how complex a relationship is as it plays out over time and how many challenges we face and how we do need those other friends and those other support networks. There's really this danger that we do suddenly think, oh, I've met somebody and now it's fine. Don't need to make an effort seeing my friends. We'll just stay in and watch TV and eat pizza and it'll all be lovely.
And it's a mistake to think, whenever I've interviewed polyamorous people before, it's an analogy they come back to over and over again, where they're just like, you wouldn't have one friend who was your friend you got drunk with, went out dancing with, went to the museums with, had really big emotional connections with, went travelling with. You know, you have different friends for different things because it's too much for one person to be expected to provide
definitely
all of that nourishment. And I suppose that's kind of the founding ethos of having multiple relationships or partners.
Yeah, it's a heck of a lot of a burden and pressure on one single person, isn't it? To expect them to be all things at all times.
The Hi-Lo is sponsored by Sainsbury's Home. Sainsbury's Home prides itself on delivering great quality design-led products at very nice prices, aka high quality design at high street prices. Sainsbury's Home has a dedicated in-house design team of 14, and 80% of Sainsbury's Home product is designed by the in-house creative team. For autumn, the Sainsbury's Home team have taken inspiration from the great British countryside, from the interiors of inner city boutique hotels and cocktail lounges. Authentic design is at the heart of how the 14 in-house designers create their exclusive prints and palettes, and this season each trend has a signature fragrance blended exclusively for Sainsbury's Home to evoke all the warmth and comfort and spice of winter. So the ranges available this September are Nordic Skies, inspired by the Nordic scenery and lifestyle. This muted tone theme exudes contemporary style, embossed textures and soft accenting of colours in materials such as wood, mercury, glass and grey faux fur. Renaissance Boutique indulge in the glamour and grandeur of the 1920s with stylish home accessories, geometric patterns and opulent skilled craftsmanship. Then you have Woodland Walk, which captures the tones and textures of an autumnal country walk, creating cosy living space with warm aubergine and mulberry colours used across chunky knits and pattern textiles. The Sainsbury's in-house design team have created a unique narrative of a woodland scene with hair figures in rich brass metallic finish and an exclusive fragrance of applewood and clove. Enjoy all of those. There is something for everyone. Thank you very much to Sainsbury's Home.
Something Dolly and I were talking about that Dolly, you raised is the idea of jealousy, which is what a lot of people who are used to being a monogamous relationship would probably say. It's definitely something I thought as soon as I picked up the book was, but I'm just such a jealous person. I wouldn't be able to imagine a secondary or a tertiary partner or to be that partner myself.
And how would you kind of respond to that, particularly with that idea of compersion or flubbly?
Is it frubbly or flubbly? I'm just obsessed with this word.
It's a good one, isn't it? There's a glossary at the back of the book.
Yeah, it's really useful.
With some new terms that I came across on this journey and adventure of talking to lots of people, opening up their relationships. There's a few terms I'm suggesting that I've sort of made up or some of my friends have made up. And one of my favourites is if you feel you've reached your threshold of relationships, you can say you're polysaturated, which is a good one. But also, yes, frubbly is a lovely one. And there's also a word compersion, and they mean the same thing. And that is when you are actually, rather than feeling jealous or threatened, feeling turned on by your partner finding happiness with somebody else and being with somebody else. So one of the key interviews towards the start of the book is with a comedian friend of mine, Kate Smurthwaite, and her partner, male partner James. They're a straight couple. And they have opened up their relationship and they've really got beyond all of that sort of feeling of jealousy and threat by kind of communicating, talking about what they're doing. And I think they feel secure that their relationship is the primary relationship and they have a commitment to that. So they feel happy about the other person going off and having a great time because they're coming back.
I think the thing is as well with relationships is that it's not one size fits all. It can't possibly be. So, and this is the thing that's also obviously worth reminding people writing the A4 letters is that anything that's an exploration is only a threat to your relationship if you let it be. You don't, you know, you can pick and choose by sort of what suits you. And I actually really like the way that you allowed your fear to sort of air itself, especially at the beginning. And I found myself really nodding along to the bit where you said, if nobody settles down and commits anymore, if we pursue individual happiness at the cost of other people's feelings, if we leave so carelessly, how can we build and maintain a stable sense of community? And I'm really interested in that sort of that fear around non-monogamy, even though no one's saying you must have this
relationship. It was just a kind of fear. I think that really came from how angry I felt at this friend of mine who was having an affair. and then sort of just one morning casually told her partner that she was leaving. And I just kind of felt, oh, that really disrupts like a whole friendship group.
Yeah.
I talk about
and a belief system.
A sort of entire landscape of friendship being eroded and this sense of a lot of things being lost, because it goes hand in hand with obviously me being a gay woman and a lot of senses of things that I've held dear in the gay community about there being a real sense of gay family in London, particularly, that sort of being lost and breaking up a bit as now that we have marriage, which of course in so many ways is such a wonderful thing. It sort of has seen a lot of really good aspects of how the gay community all stuck together and partied together. And now they're sort of breaking off into units and doing the more kind of normative thing of getting married and having nuclear families. So in some ways there has been a huge sense of loss compounded by all of this kind of political shift for gay people in this country. Society is kind of shifting. We're a very individualistic society now, with kind of the whole social media. And, you know, there's a danger towards us becoming all very narcissistic and losing senses.
And how does that kind of... How do your decisions and your relationships trigger to affect other people? Because that was someone else's relationship, but it impacted you, your friend group, what you thought of as a kind of stable relationship.
Yeah, I think
trigger effect.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of it was triggering in some way, because I think it did make me question so many things about community and our sense of how we treat one another and where we are at in society. And I talk about also a social contagion effect, where if we see our friends breaking up, we're more likely to leave our relationships as well. So to some extent, serial monogamy is sort of infectious, if you like.
Yes, absolutely, because everyone else is doing it. It's sort of, you think that's the way to do it. And another thing as well that I definitely found really interesting is when you talk about what is defined as cheating. So we all sort of think it would be, oh, well, if my partner slept with someone else. But actually, when you speak to Kazi Rahman, who says something that Dolly and I found so interesting, that it's not just bonking someone else. So he says, when you interview people who actually experience their partners cheating on them, both sexes say it was the emotional aspect, i.e. falling in love with someone else, that was the worst. And I can totally see that. Yet for some reason we have in our head, you know, well, if I caught him having sex with someone else, whereas actually that's not the biggest.
Yeah, and it's interesting what Kazi is talking about there is the difference between the people who have had it happen and the people who hypothetically are thinking about if it
Absolutely,
would happen.
Absolutely, yeah.
There was a passage in the book that struck such a chord to me, and when I spoke to Pandora, she guessed immediately which one it was, which is where you're talking about being single. You say, I wonder then if our islands of happiness are actually time spent single, when we are free to be at our most authentic and electrified. Maybe it's during our relationships that we are submerged and drowning in compromise, silenced by the crashing waves. And I think that really spoke to me, because personally, I've been on a kind of journey. I've raised those questions that you raise often through the book, where it's like, have I got a bit of an unhealthy dependence on love and kind of sexual verification? And I've really tried to cultivate in the last year a kind of sense of autonomy and a sense of self-love and I'm enough and whatever. And it is a really beautiful thing. But then on the flip side of it, as Pandora mentioned, with this whole loss of connection thing, there is sometimes a voice in my head thinking, well, is this that? Am I just becoming self-obsessed? Is there, you know, is there a lot to be learnt as well in the kind of act of loving another in a healthy and measured way? And I just wondered where your kind of boundaries were on that now.
Well, it's such a tricky balancing act, isn't it? I think I had been one of those people who had often hopped from one relationship to the other without a healthy gap in between. I do think those times spent single are often when we can really, really grow and process things that we've not handled well in previous relationships.
Kind of recharge, I suppose, and take stock.
Yeah, but I mean, I talk about the friend whose partner left her suddenly when she'd been starting to see this other person. And actually, the woman who'd been dumped was really energised and started a breakup list of all these amazing things she'd always wanted to do. But for some reason, when she'd been with somebody, kind of just hadn't bothered doing them because you could get settled into a bit of a rut and you just do stuff together and don't kind of have wild adventures or go abseiling or windsurfing or are kind of just doing lots of stuff and getting out there in the world. We sometimes just get a bit lazy when we're with someone. Mm. So I thought that was quite interesting, and I sort of called it kind of breakup energy because there was this
it
kind of...
It is a thing. I think it is a thing.
I think it is a thing because you suddenly have this real charge about you that you want to go out and do stuff in the world and meet new people. And whilst it's painful and you're sometimes feeling very, very hurt, there's positives in that energy as well. And I sort of posed the question as to whether, you know, we could even have sort of gap years in a relationship where you do go off individually and do separate stuff in that very dynamic way.
That's
and then kind of come back together. Yeah. I don't know if it could work in practice, but I just think, isn't it just interesting to throw different new ideas and possible potential relationship structures out there into the melting pot to sort of question and think about?
The thing that I found really interesting about reading the book at the same time as Dolly, and actually, in fact, working with Dolly for the last few years, is that we come from such different perspectives on that. So, as you say, Dolly, you've been very kind of protective as yourself as a single woman because it has felt very empowering. It's been very enriching to your work. Mm. You feel kind of your best self. And when I first met you, you were literally terrified of being in a relationship because you were like, this is me at my best. Whereas I've had the kind of opposite thing where my best self has been brought out by being in a relationship. It's empowered me to make better decisions and to feel more confident in the kind of work decisions I've had. But on the flip side, when you are in a, you know, a traditional heterosexual marriage, the cultural assumptions do drive me quite insane. So everyone uses my married surname, even though I haven't changed my name, and I've written about how I haven't changed my name. And I hate that idea that you function as a single social unit. So if you're invited to something, only one of you gets invited and you're expected to tell the other and to arrange your diaries. Whereas sometimes I might be free and he's not, but I'd still quite like to come, thank you very much. Yes, and if I invite you to my birthday and your husband can't come, well, I'd like you to still come. And I think it's really interesting that you are kind of either, it's that binary thing we come back to, isn't it, that you're either one or the other. And there are these quite, so you're either, as people might have thought before they read your book and become enlightened about it, you'd think, oh well, anyone polyamorous must be all, it must be like Eyes Wide Shut 24/7, just really squelchy and sexy. And if you're married, it must be you
bed
never
socks.
Do anything interesting ever again. I mean, I love bed socks, obviously.
Doesn't?
And that, you know, you can't go on a sort of like journey together. But ultimately, what it is, and this is what I found so interesting and learnt from you, Dolly, is that it really is, it comes down to how you're feeling in yourself with who you've met at that time. You might meet someone who makes you feel like you want to share yourself and what you're going through with someone else, but you might also meet someone that reminds you how much you don't want to be with someone else. And I think your book really explores all of those, and something that's so interesting, because we get a lot of questions about lack of sex drive and a diminishing libido, is that you're really honest about how your relationship with your ex-partner Jen is for 2 years, I think you said 2 years, is not a sexual one. We were quite surprised by how many emails we got about
it. A lot of emails from women
saying that they don't know how to feel and they don't know if there's something wrong with them. And
what's really interesting is how wrong you feel in this society when you're not having sex, because we live in such a sexualized society and sex is held up as the thing that, oh, you know, if you're not doing it, then there's obviously something wrong in your relationship. You should leave immediately. There's a lot of insecurity that we feel because we don't talk about it enough and we don't have those discussions where I think it does seem to be a particular thing for women, loss of libido. And, you know, interestingly, there's been a lot of stuff written about how women in particular might struggle with remaining sexually exclusive with the same partner. There was a book that was out when I was researching my original comedy show by a New York Times journalist, Daniel Bergner, called What Do Women Want? I do think it's kind of funny that, you know, we have a man telling us what do women want.
Mansplaining female sexuality.
I know. Brilliant, isn't it? But it was actually a pretty interesting book because he does interview a ton of really interesting female scientists about the work they were doing. And it's just interesting how women don't necessarily connect with the vastness of their sexuality. Whereas I think generally men sort of kind of connect with their sexuality. There's a much more direct conscious link between if they're turned on or not. Whereas women, they kind of did experience where women were shown different types of porn, you know, whether it was straight, gay, animals, whatever it was. And what the women kind of owned up to being turned on by was very, very limited, whereas actually they were measured, you know, sort of physiologically, and they were actually turned on by the whole lot of it.
And also it's interesting because I think that women, you know, like I still know female friends of mine who say that they don't masturbate or they've never masturbated.
Oh, wow.
And there's like, I still think there's a culture with women of real shame around their own sexuality.
If you asked a bunch of teenage girls, a bunch of teenage boys, I think the results would be very, it is definitely still something that's thought of as quite shaming.
Shameful and dirty. Yeah. And
hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I heard something, and I have no idea if this is bullshit, but I heard recently that in sort of like prehistoric times or whatever, or not even prehistoric times, when humans were made, men were kind of programmed to fall asleep after they had an orgasm, whereas women were energised to go again, so they could go and find another male partner in case the one they'd slept with had not produced a baby. And then when the baby's born, for the first 3 weeks, it looks much more like the father than the mother, because the mother had been off having loads of dalliances, and the father would want to make sure it was his, so it would look like him to persuade him that it was okay, it was his. So biologically, women are actually much more able and programmed to go dallying.
Lots of different sexual partners, absolutely. And, I mean, that plays out in the natural world as well, sort of promiscuous bonobos and so on.
I love that as an insult, you promiscuous bonobo.
I think that is absolutely true, that women have had that programming to sort of, you know, select the best sperm by taking many lovers, and the kind of the fittest sperm would then fertilise the egg, wouldn't it? So it's so interesting that somehow this social construct about female sexuality has come in, where it's seen as something dangerous to be repressed and to be limited.
Yes.
And that was really where ideas of monogamy came from. You know, it was all about controlling female sexuality and paternity, like you're saying. And then, unfortunately, men thought, oh, well, we might have to go along with this as well. These rules, damn it. If we're going to tell the women what to do, we might have to pretend at least to be faithful anyway.
I love how you explore those gender constructs, particularly as a lesbian in the book, where you say, you know, I thought as a lesbian that I was sort of safe from, you know, from cheating or anything destabilizing like that, because it was men that do that, and men are horrible, and women are lovely and wonderful and great and gentle and smart. And it actually really reminded me of a conversation we had about 2 years ago, when I was saying, I can't remember what, but I was saying that I thought that women could damage other women more than anyone, and Dolly was going, no, I think it's internalized misogyny, I don't think women are capable of, I think that they've you know, inherited this way of diminishing other women. And then more recently you had that sort of rather sad realization where you were like, I think I agree with you.
Yeah, I do agree with you more in certain cases, but I also think I know the way that I sometimes have behaved with men, and I don't want this to sound too blamey. And also, a good friend of mine who's a gay woman has talked about how she has behaved in the past as well with other women. Is I look back at what I've done, I thought, oh, that's not very respectful, that's not very nice, where have I got that from? Like, oh, I know where I got that from, 10 years of boys doing that to me. So I do think that there can be kind of, I don't know, we can't blame all our misgivings on straight men.
Some inherited
behaviour. But I do think that there is inherited behaviour there as well.
Sometimes I do find myself talking to my female friends, though, and I have to say to them when they are, if they're heterosexual and they're behaving this way to a man, I have to say, if this was the other way around, we'd be sitting here going, what a dickhead, I can't believe he's doing that. And because you're doing it to him, we're sort of thinking it's okay, and you're balancing the scorecard, but really, actually, no one should behave that way to each other. Let's just be honest, ghosting is never great.
Exactly, we should try and be respectful. It's hard, isn't it? We're all idiots sometimes, but and then of course you get women behaving towards women women like that in the gay community. Mm. And you sort of, if you do, you kind of feel like you're such a bad kind of feminist and you're so unsisterly because you treated your fellow woman badly. It's like, oh, no. So, yeah, there's all kinds of complex...
You have to have space to be fallible as well.
Of course, as you say, yeah, we're not goddesses. We're not all perfect.
I mean, as a feminist, you can't...
Are, of course.
You can't necessarily love anyone. Just for our last few minutes, where are you personally with monogamy or non-monogamy, and where do you think we might be going societally with it? Some big lofty
Where are we going? Well, let me get my crystal ball. Well, I mean, it's not too much of a spoiler, I don't think, to say that I do sort of come round to finding a new partner towards the end of the book and actually embracing monogamy in a sort of much more informed way. Because I think if you feel you have choices, then something like monogamy can feel much more appealing.
Yeah.
Because you can feel like there were other options. It wasn't just this thing that was assumed.
So you chose it.
If you actively embrace and choose something, it feels much nicer somehow.
So true. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I feel that I have a really healthy relationship now that is, gosh, I mean, coming up to, in a couple of months, that'll be a year, which is amazing. And it's so interesting how I started dating and I met somebody new just when I was kind of really in the middle of writing the book. Mm. And of course, that's an interesting thing on a first date to say, oh, I'm writing a book. Oh, what's it called? Ah, okay.
And are you in a monogamous relationship?
So,
right,
yes.
Now,
so we are in a monogamous relationship, sexually speaking, definitely. Although I think because we've had so many discussions about, oh, what's your book about? I think we have a sophisticated awareness and understanding of the emotional aspect and how friends are important.
And it now feels like a choice you've made rather than a...
Exactly. So, and actually, because I have met somebody, and I think it's a lot of it is to do with timing about where I've been at when I've met somebody. So I have met somebody that I have a great sexual connection with. And of course, it's so much easier to be sexually exclusive with someone with whom you're having amazing sex. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, why would I want to go anywhere else? Now, of course, it may start to get a little bit dull in a couple of years or whatever, but I think we have such a good communication around sex and about what we like and what we want that I think that we'll be okay. I mean, I hope so. I know relationships are hard, but it's just when I've had relationships before, and this is an area where I've been really fallible. I haven't been good enough at talking about sex and what I need and what I want and what my fantasies are and all of these kind of things. I've just been very, very limited in my communication of those. Whereas now, perhaps as a result of doing these comedy shows and this book, I'm so much better at that. Mm.
Does that make you look differently at the non-sexual relationship that you did have for a few years? Or do you think it is possible to have a happy, non-sexual monogamous relationship?
I think it's tough in this society because we're so sexual in the way we discuss and talk about.
And you are happier now in a sexual
relationship. I am actually, but I don't know if that is, a lot of that is to do with societal pressure.
Right, yeah.
And so it's difficult to say whether it's what I need as a human being or it's what I need as a human being in this society where I'm told that I should be having sex. But obviously sex is lovely and sex is really nice and relieves stress and makes me feel connected to my partner and to myself. So, yes, I think there are a whole number of reasons why I feel happier. But when I was in the non-sexual relationship, I was masturbating. I still felt in some way connected to my sexual side. So I think it's really tricky. But, I mean, the really good part is that myself and my ex, Jen, we have a really ongoing friendship. And I still feel like...
It's so lovely to read that.
And I think that was so important to me that I didn't want some acrimonious breakup and some kind of... I never want to talk to you again and screaming and shouting and breaking things because it hadn't been like that. It was just like something, just one aspect of the relationship just wasn't quite working. And, you know, it was really key to me to still maintain some close connection with her and long may that continue. I hope that it does and I believe that it will. You know, to some extent, you could argue that that's a sort of slightly polyamorous way of thinking, even though I'm sexually exclusive in my new relationship. But, you know, my new partner...
Well, she even really suggests that Jen moves back in with you because liked living with each other. But then Jen was like, no, I need something
more.
Has the book changed your opinion of monogamy, Dolly, whether, again, personally or societally?
Well, it's something I've always been really interested in because I've found monogamous relationships so difficult, so bad at them, and I always kind of find myself unsatisfied. But there's a very annoying gap with me between who I am and who I like to think I am. So
I think that's in a lot of us.
Yeah, I think I call it bohemian dysmorphia. So like I really wanted to be bisexual and I really tried and it's just like I just couldn't be. I really wanted to be polyamorous, but I'm just naturally so monogamous, and that's fine. I think the thing that's really important that you say in your book is like it's about questioning and being open-minded.
And conversations.
And conversations rather than I'm one thing or the other. So, yeah, thank you very much for opening my eyes to all that.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, Rosie, for taking the time to come on to The High-Low. We found your book fascinating and funny and really moving and kind of unexpected in areas, and actually taught us a lot as well. Is there anything you would like to plug? Do you have a show coming up? Where can we find you on social media?
Yes. Great question. Well, I'm at Rosie Wilby on social media, on Twitter, at Rosie Wilby, R-O-S-I-E-W-I-L-B-Y, and my Facebook page is Rosie Wilby. And I do have a couple of events under the heading The Breakup Monologues, which is sort of the final part of my trilogy about love and relationships. And the follow-on from Is Monogamy Dead was a show called The Conscious Uncoupling about relationship endings. And a sister project to that is The Breakup Monologues, where I piloted it at Edinburgh Fringe, and I sort of have a sort of comedy therapy session where other comedian friends on the circuit come and tell me their relationship breakup stories. And so
amazing.
We kind of have a therapy session on stage, and it's really, really fun. And I've got an event at the Vauxhall Tavern in Vauxhall on the 11th of October with Pippa Evans, who is amazing. And we've also got one on the 17th of November at Rich Mix with the wonderful Elf Lyons, who was actually shortlisted for the main comedy prize in Edinburgh. So,
and can you book those through your Twitter? Will there be a
you'll be able to find my links, or if you just Google Breakup Monologues Rosie Wilby, you'll find it. But I am tweeting those event links out. So yes, and I do hope people obviously enjoy the book. It's available paperback,
it's
Kindle,
out now.
And
it's
audiobook as well.
So you can listen. Yes, you can listen to it as
you
well.
You can listen to it. That is available as well.
Thank you so much to everyone who listened to The High-Low. Do tweet us at The High-Low Show or email us thehighlowshow@gmail.com. We are back again next Wednesday. Thank you very much to Wardour Studio for letting us use your little cubby horn.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.